And we will move on to case two for this morning, United States against Watkins. Mr. McGowan.
May it please the court, counsel, Andrew McGowan for the Federal Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois, representing the appellant in this case, Shane Watkins. Mr. Watkins appealed the partial denial of the motion to suppress his confession. To affirm on this record, this court must be able to answer the basic question why the district court suppressed statements to the first officer to question Mr. Watkins and not the confession that Mr. Watkins made in direct response to the first officer's unlawful interrogation.
You mean Officer Marion's interrogation?
I mean Officer Moore's interrogation.
Because isn't the essence of the district court's finding here that by the time Mr. Watkins makes the really incriminating remarks, he's really just volunteered the statements? When Marion comes in, it's just a conversation?
To the extent that the record reflects some sort of comment by the district court, yes. I believe that the district court made that ruling. However, in this case, that comment, that confession, was in direct response to Officer Moore's unlawful interrogation. And this is why I say this. Officer Moore arrested Mr. Watkins.
Okay. Adam is Miranda. What is your definition of interrogation?
Oh, it's a definition that the court has imposed. It's simply statements designed to elicit an incriminating response.
And that would not be just casual conversation about,
well,
you've
I don't
lost
believe
a lot of weight or something like that.
I don't believe that Officer Moore's conversation was casual.
You're Marion. Focusing on Moore saying,
but I'm focusing
we found
on
the woman's jacket and where's your girlfriend, that part?
Exactly.
Okay, just to pin that down, you're not talking about anything that Marion...
We argue that Marion's statements were not harmless either, and they were interrogation in our
they
brief.
They were interrogation, Marion's
I believe
statements.
They were. It's not so clear.
Are they because of what Moore had just said? I mean, would you agree that if out of the blue Marion had just come up and said, hey, you've lost a lot of weight, that wouldn't, you know, or boy, I remember that high-speed car chase, you know, the good old days.
I think it would have been a lot more problematic and probably we wouldn't have this argument. But Officer Moore's comments, the part that I want to focus on Officer Moore's comment was when he said, if you're not going to talk to us, we're going to go talk to your girlfriend. You're not going to talk to us about the cocaine. Now, the reason I say that it's a response to Officer Moore's statement is, what Mr. Watkins' confession is, hey, talk to your boy for me. And Officer Marion believed that that was Officer Moore. Tell him that my girl didn't have anything to do with this. Let her have peace. My guy out in front didn't have anything to do with this either. This is in direct response to Moore's unlawful interrogation, confronting him with the drugs after he asked for an attorney, confronting him with, we're going to go talk to your girlfriend if you don't talk to us. That's what he's responding to.
Does he actually say that? I think he makes the comment about we've discovered cocaine in the woman's jacket and we're going to have to interview the girlfriend about it. But he never completes, maybe you're arguing it's implicit, but he never says, because you're not talking to us. He just says,
actually,
we're going to talk to her.
Actually, he does. The record reflects that Moore says, I told him that since he wasn't going to give me a statement about the cocaine that was found, that I would be talking to his girlfriend about the cocaine. That's a quote from his testimony at the motion to suppress. Mm-hmm. He threatened, in one sense.
Well, why is that a threat and not just a statement of fact?
It's surely something he can do. But it's designed to elicit an incriminating response. If you don't talk to us about this cocaine, we're going after your girlfriend.
Well, okay.
That's our argument. In any event, I'd also like to address the harmless error argument that the government makes. This was after a trial, after all. Of course, this is a confession. It's very significant. It's not just a confession inculpating Mr. Watkins. It's also a confession that exculpates the two other possible people that could be responsible for these drugs. A part of the drugs, over 25 grams, were found in a woman's jacket in a closet, and the other over 25 grams were found on outside of the closet on a table in the bedroom. And I think in this case, harmless error analysis has to include whether the government can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was responsible for both of those bags, because Mr. Watkins was sentenced to natural life based on the statutory three strikes in a drug case requirement. And the government had, there was a special jury instruction for the jury to find out how much drugs he was responsible for and what type they were. And the jury found that it was over 50 grams. And that's what his natural life sentence is based on. So I believe that any harmless error analysis should include the fact that without the confession, you've got two other possible people involved, one of whom is a woman, and there's drugs in a woman's coat. The other of whom was there in the house. He had marijuana in his coat. He had crack cocaine on the seat in the car that he was sitting in just right before he went in the house. And he was running away from the very area that the crack was found. And for those reasons, we don't believe the government can establish harmless
error. Wouldn't there at least have been joint possession, though? I mean, if they find Watkins, right, squished down by the side of the bed.
He was there. There's no question he was there. And but, of course, mere presence and mere knowledge are not sufficient to establish.
But this isn't mere presence like he's watching TV. I mean, this is a little bit different.
It's mere presence. He was hiding from, not hiding, he was down on the floor. The officers came in, officers, police warrant. You know, he knows who officers are. There's no question about that. And he was down on the floor. And, in fact, one of the officers, I believe, testified. He said, get down, maybe not to him directly, but as they were coming in the house. For those reasons, Your Honor, we believe that the district court's ruling should be overruled. And if there are no more questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Sure.
Thank you.
Why don't you save the rest of your time for rebuttal, and so as not to force your opponent to stop mid-sentence, we may take our – we will call this 10 o'clock. Every clock in this building is different anyway, so I'm sure it's 10 o'clock somewhere, and the court will, in fact, pause for 2 minutes in commemoration of Michael Lefko and of Donna Humphrey. Thank you very much, everybody. We will all devoutly hope and pray that no such things happen again. And we will ask Mr. Murphy to present his argument.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Brad Murphy, an assistant U.S. attorney from Peoria, Illinois. There are two givens that I'd like to start with here. First, that the police are not prohibited from listening to a defendant's volunteered statements. And secondly, the district court here failed to make explicit findings of fact or credibility determinations in its ruling. However, this case presents the appropriate context that was not present in the previous Talkington and Fields cases for this court to apply the any reasonable view of the evidence standard utilized by several other circuits. There are three factors that I want to draw the court's attention to.
But Mr. Murphy, there's one reason why this may not be this case, which I don't think is unfavorable to the government, actually. But by the time all is said and done, particularly in the sidebar or the motion in limine at the trial, the district court really does flesh out some of his thinking about how he viewed that statement, that pair of statements, really, the Moore encounter and more particularly the Marion encounter. And so is there any reason we shouldn't look at what the judge says during the trial?
That is an alternative, I believe, that's open to the court. You may or not, may use the entire record, not only from the motion to suppress, but from the trial as well. I view those statements of Judge McDade as statements of, or reasons, if you will. He's not, at that point in time, making findings of fact, but he is explaining his rationale from earlier. And that's why I was suggesting that the court may well consider this to be a case in which there still are no direct findings of fact or credibility determinations, only statements of the intent.
Well, I mean, he says, I thought my ruling was that that was a voluntary statement by the defendant. He wasn't being interrogated by Officer Marion. Now, I recognize, you know, it's not quite in a temporal sequence, but I'm a little concerned about this no reasonable person could think anything standard, given the fact that we really do rely very much on district court judges to make findings of fact, and we're not mind readers. But if the district court judge has told us what he's thinking, then it strikes me, as long as it's all still within the trial, he's not writing some op-ed 10 years later. He's telling us in the course of the trial what he was thinking. Why? I don't know why that wouldn't be a reliable gauge.
The government does believe it's a reliable gauge, and whether this court considers it to be findings of fact, which you will agree with and affirm, or whether this court considers it to be statements which you can rely on to know that the judge made the right decision with uncontroverted testimony, looking at the right legal issue, and implicitly crediting the officer's testimony. He should be affirmed in either case. I do wish to respond, however, to counsel's harmless error argument, because it becomes even more appropriate if this court does find that any reasonable view of the evidence standard does not apply here. I would suggest the court, in response to that, that the girlfriend testified. The government called this girlfriend. Her credibility was put in issue. On page 29 of the government's brief, I summarize what I believe is the strength of the government's case, setting aside the statement altogether. And I submit that the girlfriend, after her credibility was put in evidence, and the jury made that determination that she had no idea when she left for work that afternoon at 3 o'clock there was any drugs, any money, anywhere about that apartment, other than she thought there might have been some money there from her income tax refund, is my recollection.
But, you know, what she said really made so little difference, given the fact that you were able to use this confession. Had that not come in, I mean, I'm not sure whether the jury would have believed a statement like that from her. The drugs were in a woman's coat. Seems to me there are all sorts of things you might have said about her knowledge that could have been different.
Again, with her testimony, however, the government submits that that's another piece in the analysis of the harmless error, and the jury had that decision to make. The jury made the decision and found beyond a reasonable doubt, per the verdict forms, that it was the defendant who was in possession of more than 50 grams of the drugs.
No, that's certainly true in the face of the evidence that was in front of them. I guess, you know, your opponent's theory is that first, after he invokes his Miranda rights, first you have Moore saying, well, because you're not going to talk to us, we'll go put the arm on your girlfriend, and then Marion softens him up with, you know, some reminiscing about old times, and he feels comfortable, so he lets his guard down, and he and it's really all of a piece of a sophisticated interrogation technique.
That was a good deal of speculation by defense counsel at the motion to suppress. That was not borne out by the facts, I would submit, Your Honor. When you get right down to it, Officer Marion is turning to leave the bathroom. The defendant says, "See you in the next lifetime. I'm going away for a long time." The only thing Officer Marion says is the words, "All right." The defendant then spits out this confession. Legally speaking, I suggest to you the words, "All right," were not intended to elicit any incriminating response, and hence there was no interrogation. Thank you.
Mr. McGowan?
Your Honors, when you look at what Judge McDade said at the trial, I'd like you to take into account the fact that he did not discuss that Marion was actually asking questions. Now, I know that his questions were kind of innocuous on the face of it, but they started out with Marion knowing that Mr. Watkins didn't want to talk. It's a kind of a one-upmanship. You say, "Do you remember me?" "Yes." Okay. So there's an interrogation there. It's not maybe legal interrogation at that point, but it's the questioning. It's getting the guy to talk when he said he didn't want to talk. And then he's talking about an old offense. And one of the ways this court could look at that is I gotcha. Here's a guy. He's not dressed. He's sitting on a toilet. He's got handcuffs. And the officer comes in and says, "Oh, don't you look good?" So I think there's a little more to this than just simply reminiscing about old times. And I'd also like to point out that the judge's comments, because they don't address the whole nature of that discussion during a trial, and it's surprising that he went into as much detail as he did, actually, but because they don't address that, they don't really provide the kind of analysis that this court expects from district courts when they're making rulings about issues like this. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel. And we will take this case under advisement.